This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Yik. Healthcare is supposed to be healing, but in reality, a medical experience, such as the diagnosis of an illness or a hospital stay, can be very traumatizing. Consultant psychiatrist and geriatric psychiatrist Dr. Bharathi Vengadasalam explains how medically induced PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder is becoming a greater concern, especially as we are living longer with more chronic medical conditions. Good afternoon, Dr. Bharathi. Thank you for joining us today.
Okay. Good afternoon, shall we?
Can we start first by explaining what is PTSD?
Okay. So a post-traumatic stress disorder is a mental health problem that occurs to some people after they've experienced or witnessed a traumatic event. And there are several symptoms, which I can go into later, but these traumatic events are events that they perceive as life-threatening to them. Some of those traumatic events could be like a car accident or an assault, a sexual assault or a physical assault, natural disasters, for example. But today we are speaking specifically about things that could happen in the medical setting, I understand.
Yes, so this came up in some research that I was doing, and it had never occurred to me that we could be looking at PTSD in the medical setting, in a sense that it is provoked by a medical experience. So could you sort of further narrow it down? And what is medically induced PTSD?
Okay, so medically induced PTSD refers to medical trauma, right? Where there are a set of physiological and psychological responses that some patients experience in certain new medical events. For example, when there's any life-threatening emergency medical care, like after a heart attack or a diagnosis of a stroke, for example, you could see it in the ICU when they've required intense sedation. You can see it after being given a life-threatening or life-altering diagnosis, like cancer, for example, or a long-term deteriorating diagnosis like Alzheimer's disease or multiple sclerosis. And other medical settings would, you know, include things which are not necessary just about the elderly, for example, after childbirth, a traumatic childbirth for some women, mm-hmm. when they've had to have like an emergency caesarean section, mm-hmm. or there is a loss of their child during childbirth.
Of course.
Yeah. So other medical diagnoses would be things like HIV, for example. So these sort of events create a sense of vulnerability and fear. And the situation would be that the person who is subjected to such a medical event feels a lot of helplessness, powerlessness, and fear of mortality. So it triggers a post-traumatic stress response, which sometimes goes unrecognized.
When you say that it triggers that response, why is it that these medical experiences are so significant, so strong, as to have the same impact as what you described earlier of a car accident or people who have been in war? That's what we generally associate PTSD as. So what is it about a medical experience that generates such a primitive response?
Well, firstly, medical experiences, the underlying denominator, okay, between the previous traumatic events you've said and a medical event is this, the threat to themselves, right? It's going to be a new challenge. Perhaps there's going to be a loss of function. There's going to be a loss of a role. They may enter a hospital and have to face strangers or separation from their loved ones. They may feel that life after this is going to be very, very different. And it's also being subject to a lot of procedures which they are not used to. Medical experiences are a threat to a person's basic integrity, their sense of being whole, and creates a lot of vulnerability whether recurrences could happen. These medical events, for example, you know, your sleep is disrupted in the ICU. Things like the lighting is different, the very unfamiliar environment, all this can create anxiety and fear. So there are persons who are more vulnerable to getting a post-traumatic stress disorder. So I must reiterate that it doesn't mean that everyone who experiences a traumatic event must have a post-traumatic response, mm-hmm. because nearly everyone will have a normal range of reactions. Mm-hmm. And after a while, those reactions subside. So for the first few weeks, any one of us, it's a normal human response to feel edgy or to feel the inability to cope and temporarily needing their life to readjust. Mm-hmm. But these, as I said, these symptoms subside. But for some people only, these symptoms last a very long time. They're very intense. And those are the people who may experience post-traumatic stress. I could go through some of the scenarios of various conditions in the medical setting.
Yes, please.
For example, the ICU, right? So when people are admitted into ICU, you have a very long, prolonged period of sedation. Mm-hmm. And in that sedation, which is, let's say, too heavy or heavy for them, their memories can be very, very fragmented. And they may misinterpret things. They may feel that the catheters that are being put in are invading them. Mm-hmm. They may have a sense of confusion about tubes being pulled out and put in. So these create a lot of fear. And because they can't construct their memories well, when they leave and there's been no explanation, they may feel quite traumatized about the ICU experience.
Is this a physiological effect of the sedatives and how it affects their emotions?
Well, it has been recognized. I mean, the anesthesiologists, they're experts in this area. There has been a recognition that benzodiazepines that are used in the ICU, which are needed, they are needed to, of course, help a person be comfortable during ventilation, that can create a fragmented sleep, mm-hmm. disrupting what we call the rapid eye movement sleep at night, and the lightings that are different, and all the amount of sedation that's given. Also, sometimes patients may find it difficult to articulate their pain. In that way, you know, pain may be felt by the patient, mild pain, which may not be well expressed.
Of course.
Yeah. So those sort of things can be really frightening for patients.
I presume a major surgical procedure like a heart bypass would also be one of the triggers for somebody who may not be able to cope very well. Mm. How common is that?
That is. It's been known that for cardiac surgery, up to a quarter, 10 to 25% of patients can actually have a post-traumatic stress disorder after cardiac surgery, even after a stroke and after a heart attack. So because of the post-traumatic stress, it is something that needs to be addressed because it actually quite puts them at risk of a second cardiac event in the future.
Right.
It actually elevates their risk of an acute coronary syndrome.
Right.
You know, because the anxiety and the post-traumatic stress creates changes in the body even. Mm-hmm. You know, it causes like inflammation. It sometimes can make patients avoid coming back to the hospital because coming back to the hospital is a reminder of what happened to them.
Right.
Right? So they may not seek the care that they wish. Some patients even start avoiding taking certain medicines because taking those medicines mean that it's a reminder of the trauma, you see?
Yes.
So they become quite non-adherent. So it is quite worrying when patients develop post-traumatic stress disorders after a medical event.
So one of the indicators there would be if patients don't come back for follow-ups, there should be cause for investigating whether the trauma is causing that behavior, right?
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned that a certain proportion, everyone has a normal range of reactions.
Yes.
Certain proportion are more prone to it developing into PTSD. Do we know what makes some people more prone than others?
So, there are risk factors to developing post-traumatic stress disorder. Women somehow do seem to be more prone. Mm-hmm. Also, family genetics. okay, having a family history of depression and anxiety,
mm-hmm.
or if a patient has had pre-existing depression and anxiety. But even despite all this, suppose you have a patient who's been exposed to trauma in the past, let's say even childhood abuse or sexual abuse in the past, or a preceding accident 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The second trauma, okay, is the trauma that in which triggers the PTSD, mm-hmm. although he's been exposed to a previous one.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact remains that any prior exposure to trauma many years ago puts a patient at risk for PTSD in the second trauma.
Mm-hmm.
We have talked about things like personality traits, coping mechanisms, people who are avoidant or particularly anxious. They may be quite prone to this. Patients who've had a lot of substance abuse,
mm-hmm.
That seems to put them at risk. And substance abuse itself is sometimes an indicator that a person may have undergone post-traumatic stress in the past.
And this is their way of coping.
Coping, yes. Self-medicating.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
How prevalent, I don't know if you have numbers or just from your observation, how prevalent is medically induced PTSD?
You know, medically induced PTSD is really one of those areas that are evolving, and there needs to be more research into it. It has been hard to do research because it's very hard to define some of the cases, and patients are sometimes lost to follow up. But the sort of studies that have been coming up when we look at, let's say, the prevalence of particular studies, about 12 to 25% of patients with acute life-threatening event for sure get it. Heart attacks, strokes and cancers. ICU admissions would be about 10 to 30%.
30%?
Yes.
It's very high.
It is very high. Myocardial infarcts, which is your heart attack and strokes, I mean, 10 to 20% have been quoted. Elderly falls at least 15 to 30%.
Right.
Do have post-traumatic stress disorder after a fall, and sometimes they avoid walking after that and don't become quite housebound and agoraphobic, you know.
So that reaction is actually PTSD.
Yes. So PTSD has a certain diagnostic criteria. And we have to define it formally, because if we don't, then anybody would be diagnosed to have PTSD, and we should not, you know. So we do stick to a particular criteria.
Okay.
So we tend to follow something called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM-5. And in there, the formal definition goes across 4 categories of symptoms. And patients need to have symptoms across all those categories,
right.
Not just 1 or 2 symptoms in these 2 categories.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a category 1, 2, 3, 4, let's say. Category 1, you need 1 symptom from that. The second category, you need another. And the third and fourth category, you need at least 2.
Right.
So it's you need to understand what those categories are, because there are specific things which indicate post-traumatic stress disorder. Like the first category would really be talking about re-experiencing the event, reliving it.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels horrible because, you know, patients would have like flashbacks or nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about the event would create really a physical response to them. And when they think about the event, they feel either bodily distress or psychological distress. And everything seems to be so vivid to them when they relive it. So these are some of the symptoms that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, which is quite difficult, they can start avoiding reminders of the event, which means that they could avoid medications, they could avoid checkups, they could avoid talking about it to someone, and they can become very isolated.
Would denial perhaps they try to pretend as if it never happened? Would that be one of the behaviors?
Yes, that would be, yes, you know. And there's a lack of sharing about it in terms of avoidance symptoms.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So the category 3 would be about the changes of the way they think and they feel. So patients can feel like as though it's always going to happen again. They can feel quite negative. They can have negative thoughts. They can detach from their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
They can feel quite emotionally numb,
mm-hmm.
Empty.
Right.
Yeah. And so these thoughts can affect the way they want to take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And finally, the last part of the categories, we look at things which causes hyper arousal. That means there's something in their body which becomes hyper vigilant.
Right.
They get irritable outbursts.
Anger
outbursts, exactly, mm-hmm. you know. And this sort of hyperarousal means that they often feel very keyed up and very, very tensed,
mm-hmm.
you know. So they never relax. They constantly feel on the edge.
But that seems in contrast to being emotionally numb.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So that part about the arousal is a little bit different because the danger is over, let's say. You know, there's no imminent danger right now, but they still are not able to let their guard down. Yeah. And emotionally numb, so a patient with PTSD doesn't have to have all these symptoms.
Right.
You know, just one here, two here, thin, but mm-hmm. it is the fact that they must have across board symptoms in each category.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there's a very strict diagnostic
yes,
criteria, as
yes.
you mentioned.
Yes.
We have to go for a break now.
Yes.
But when we come back, we'll talk more about pain.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the poorly defined areas in a medical experience. And people, on the one hand, feel so strongly about the pain that they're going through, but yet sometimes don't get the attention that they need to address it.
Yes,
so
yes.
I'd like to find out how that's linked
yes,
to PTSD.
Yes.
I'm speaking to consultant psychiatrist and geriatric psychiatrist, Dr. Bharathi Vengadesalam, about PTSD that occurs after a traumatic medical experience. We'll be back after the break on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show. I'm T. Xiaoyik, and today I'm speaking to consultant psychiatrist and geriatric psychiatrist, Dr. Bharathi Vengadesalam, about medically induced PTSD. And this can include the diagnosis of a serious illness or a medical event such as surgery, a heart attack, or having to be in ICU for a prolonged period of time. And before the break, Dr. Bharathi had explained what are the diagnostic criteria and the symptoms that fall within certain categories that have to be sort of fulfilled before you can confirm that somebody is actually going through PTSD. I would like to find out, how is pain linked to PTSD?
You know, Xiaoyik, it's such a vicious cycle. People who've experienced PTSD in the past, okay, or trauma, let's say trauma, okay, they are already at risk of pain, right? And chronic pain is a threat to a person's body.
Mm-hmm.
So the chronic pain itself becomes a reminder of the original trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So the pain is worse for people with PTSD, and having PTSD worsens the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So it does become quite a vicious cycle. Survivors of childhood or sexual abuse sometimes can have chronic pelvic pain or chronic back pain. And war veterans who have undergone, let's say, physical injury during combat, they may suffer pain and acute pain during the time of injury, and later on, by right, that pain, let's say, should subside. But often chronic pain remains because it's a leftover scar. It's a scar, almost a psychological scar of the original trauma. And chronic pain it really requires a holistic sort of approach, especially for patients with PTSD, because in management, they'll have to look at the original trauma
mm-hmm.
and what that signified to this person. And often that's why patients with chronic pain and PTSD end up having a lot of substance abuse problems, because they would, let's say, self-medicate with alcohol and drugs, you know, and that again worsens the cycle.
Mm.
You know?
But pain is so subjective.
Mm.
How would you first be able to even diagnose that it is part of the cycle?
Okay, so yes, you're right. Pain is subjective, and that's why it's important not to negate a patient's pain, because what may seem painful to the patient may not be painful to the person observing. So it is a fact that chronic pain is a very intense and complex area that really has required kind of multidisciplinary input, surprisingly from pain specialists like anesthesiologists. So going back to the chronic pain, well, we usually have ratings. It helps. We discover the rating of the pain, the frequency, the severity. What are a patient's thoughts about the pain when it occurs? Because if a patient's thoughts about the pain are catastrophic to them and it creates a lot of fear, it will cause a rebound of the pain cycle, because everything that goes through the spinal, the pain pathway, tend to the brain, and when it's augmented by the emotions in the limbic system, automatically the feedback to the pain would be greater. That's why people who are depressed with pain have a greater pain perception than people who are not depressed without pain.
Right. Okay. When I was doing my research on this topic, I came in with the assumption that medical PTSD would be more common among older adults and the elderly, simply because they would be in the age group where they are more prone to developing medical conditions and being hospitalized. Is this an accurate assumption, or are you actually seeing it across age groups?
I see it across age groups, although logically, we would think that it would be greater, the rates would be greater in the elderly, and there are significant rates in the elderly, but those rates are also significant in the younger and middle-aged population. And surprisingly, the studies have been quite variable with regards to prevalence, you know, in older people. The original thought was that older people in the ICU, for example, would have higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder than a younger individual. But that was not shown to be true because there are many older people who are already more inclined to ideas of mortality compared to a younger individual. And sometimes the younger individuals who come into the ICU, they've come in because of car accidents and a linked trauma. So that itself puts them at risk of PTSD, especially if they've been, you know, under the influence of alcohol or
drugs. So there's sort of a double whammy there.
Correct. So it's so hard to talk about whether it's more in the elderly and less in the younger. But logically, yes, we do see that. We do see that older people are more exposed to different life events. But you see, cancer can occur in a middle-aged person or a young individual. So we've also seen that aspect. Most of the time, some of the older patients of ours who've come in with PTSD has often been after a fall, actually, or even delirium.
And can you perhaps give some examples of some of the other, the middle and the younger age groups? What are the instances that have triggered their PTSD?
Okay, so you know, the original studies, this original topic came up because they actually had examined childhood adult survivors of childhood cancer. That's how medically induced PTSD first came about. But nowadays, in terms of the younger population, when we see PTSD in the medical setting, well, young, I mean, as in general adult, it's usually after a life-altering diagnosis. As I said earlier, cancer, a life-threatening diagnosis like, let's say, HIV, a heart attack now, which is happening in younger people, people in age in their 30s and 40s, gynecological issues, traumatic childbirth, as mentioned, even something like an anaphylactic shock, you know, having a very severe allergic reaction, which brings you into the ED with a threat to your life because your throat chokes up and your face has become swollen, and then you think that you're going to die, you know. So those situations have come up, and illnesses such as that, because even now we are seeing young hypertensives and younger stroke survivors, and many of them have experienced PTSD after having a stroke.
Does the ability to cope with the trauma, does it differ between a younger and older age group?
So that would be more relevant in terms of access to social support. Right? So it's about the social support a person receives, and it's also about access to resources, right? So To tease out those factors have been quite hard, but it is a good predictor of how far someone can recover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what sort of discussions were made post diagnosis, or whether when a patient comes back after their hospitalization, do we as clinicians ever sit and discuss what was the recent health scare that they had.
Mm.
So I guess age-wise, I would say traditionally people have thought that older people, would they be able to cope less? I mean, it's so individual. It's about family support. If an older person is very isolated, yes, then it would be quite difficult for them compared to a younger person. Yeah.
Okay. How do you treat PTSD?
Okay, so PTSD itself, once it's diagnosed, we would try and do a combination of a few things. It should be holistic. We usually offer a form of psychotherapy, okay, and I'll try and go into what are those forms, and the possibility of adding on medication. So it could be medication, it can be psychotherapy, but most often it's a combination of both. So medications-wise, nowadays we tend to use antidepressants. Although you don't think that patients with PTSD suffer from, let's say, a major depression, but how those antidepressants help is they help in sleep, they help to stop some of that irritability, alleviate some of the negative thoughts and the emotions, which can go a long way.
Right.
And so we occasionally may combine it with temporary anti-anxiety medicines.
Mm-hmm.
But the mainstay would be talk therapies also, you know.
Okay.
And talk therapies would be important because they actually go into they help patients identify their automatic thoughts around the trauma and help them learn to challenge it, okay, or reframe it.
Right.
So this is a form of psychotherapy that is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And nowadays, in the area of trauma, okay, even medical trauma, we find that mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapies are really a good way to go, a mindfulness approach.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the goals are to help patients have good relaxation training,
mm-hmm.
so that they don't get too over alert about some of the symptoms that they are feeling, you know, their cues and reminders. And the goal is to help them redefine their body in a very safe way and reconnect with it. Also helps them tell their story, because it's very important for a patient to be able to retell their trauma story. Even though the trauma is about something that happened in a medical setting, the problem when it happens in a medical setting is some patients are quite either ashamed of talking about it because they feel maybe it's too small a matter to bother anyone with, and they tend to feel very isolated, or they don't want to talk about it because it's avoidance,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it becomes too big and too fragmented, these memories. So in therapy, retelling the trauma story in a safe way to the therapist goes a long way for a patient to reconstruct the story in a very coherent way, you know, to kind of build meaning into it, and to grow from it, to grow from what has happened. It also helps the therapist address any misperceptions, because there'll be things like guilt or self-blame which needs to be discussed. And even just self-care strategies like getting good sleep, eating right, avoiding alcohol and drugs, you know, getting them to do that journaling.
Mm-hmm.
Journaling helps a lot. And getting patients to find creative outlets, to convert all that negative energy and to display, I wouldn't say displace it, but to convert it into something better.
Okay.
So this means that they really need to learn to keep their mind occupied in a purposeful, meaningful way. Not everything needs analysis all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the trauma story is always shared with the therapist, but the rest of the time, how are you going to normalize in your daily routine and life? And where does the family come in, you know?
Yes, yeah. That was was going to be my next point. What is the role of the family and perhaps the rest of the medical team within the therapy?
So, you know that based on some of the symptoms we had discussed about PTSD, it can really affect the family member,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because things like irritability, anger outbursts, aggression, even distancing, because they become emotionally quite numb and they get quite detached from family members. So it would be quite hard for some family members to understand this. And may I also add, it's not just about it happening to the patient. PTSD can happen to the family member of a patient.
In what instances?
Because they witness the traumatic event. Okay, so we've had children or whose parents have become unwell
mm-hmm.
and suddenly having a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
they could actually also have PTSD.
Right.
Because they witnessed a life-threatening event happening to their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to your original question about how are family going to come on board, you see, understanding and being aware that this could be a post-traumatic stress response will then help family members not to blame, not to give the patient support, to give the patient safe space, to allow the patient to share their story, okay? But the other thing is that if family members are involved in some of the care in a balanced way, it would really help. Some of the examples that have been shown is, for example, in the ICU, because often family feel quite traumatized seeing their loved one in the ICU.
Absolutely.
Okay? It's yes. quite traumatic for some family members. Having, using the visiting time to focus on what you can do for your loved one
mm-hmm.
while the patient is bedridden,
mm-hmm.
All tubed up, like even things like massaging, putting lip balm on the lips,
mm-hmm.
feeling constructive can go quite a long way into helping a family member connect with their unwell loved one.
In a way you know? Where you feel like you are doing something
Correct.
To help.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, you've brought up such a good topic today, I think, which is never really been discussed. So even as clinicians and in healthcare, whether public or private healthcare, many, many clinicians are not so aware of the degree of post-traumatic stress that their patient may have undergone after a health event. Because, I mean, to be fair, with the time constrained, you're very focused on the physical. Right? So we need to dialogue with our patients after a patient has had a surgery or a heart attack or even if that patient is not our regular patient, understanding that, oh, 3 months ago you went in with a diagnosis of, you went for a scope and they diagnosed you to have, let's say, stage one cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you take that? You know, how was that for you? You know, mm-hmm. How are you feeling now? You know, or if you had undergone cardiac surgery, I see that you underwent cardiac surgery. How was that for you? You know, that must have been quite hard. How was it for your family? So it enables a discussion where clinicians could assess whether patients are going to potentially experience PTSD and is that going to affect other illnesses, because PTSD has many serious complications for patients in the medical setting.
Mm. So in the event that PTSD is missed
mm.
and it goes on, mm. what are the consequences?
So PTSD that has occurred in a medical setting, okay, can later on result in depression, anxiety. It can cause non-compliance, or what I say, non-adherence to a patient's medications.
Mm-hmm.
They may stop coming for follow-up. Okay. Then the other problem here is that on its own, PTSD left untreated becomes a risk factor for further physical disease,
mm.
which is something that many people don't realize, because PTSD after a heart attack has actually doubled the chance of a second heart attack.
Yes.
And that's been shown in several studies. One of the best studies on it is by a chap called Edmondson from Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really, really clearly shown that within 2 years, okay, to 3 years, there was a second cardiac event and the risk of dying was greater. So we can't miss this, you know, because trauma has a very, very physiological response mm. in the body.
Mm-hmm.
It causes inflammation and it causes changes in our neurohormones, which do impact the physical body as much as the mental body.
But it's, in a way, I can understand how difficult it is to even identify that this is happening to yourself or your family. That would be an interesting train of thought to pursue. So when we come back from the break, we'll find out more about that. I've been speaking to consultant psychiatrist and geriatric psychiatrist, Dr. Bharathi Vengadesalam, about medical PTSD. We'll come back after the break on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show. I'm T. Shao Ik. Today I'm speaking to consultant psychiatrist and geriatric psychiatrist Dr. Bharathi Vengadesalam about medically induced PTSD, which can be triggered by serious medical events like an illness, a procedure, or a stint in, let's say, the ICU or the hospital, or after certain conditions like the elderly having a fall. And what I would like to find out is, how can family members, you know, recognize that this is not just in that person's head, not just in the mind, but and it's not just the person being difficult or being a cranky patient, you know. How do we get them to help that person, you know, get help?
Okay, that is where I think that family members would need to be part and parcel of some of the healthcare discussions. Not all, because a patient needs privacy to process it themselves with their clinician. But, you know, support goes a long way. So family members, if they have questions and they're unsure of how their loved one's behavior has changed, they should actually consult the treating doctor. Look, I'm noticing that this has happened since the heart attack. Could you tell me if this is normal? You know, because to me, I think he's acting up. Okay. Sometimes they'll say that, you know. So that's when, you know, it helps that clinicians are aware of the impact of a medical event on their patient. Because the medical event can be over, but it isn't really over, is it?
Yes.
Because your body has changed. There's something within you that's changed, and those are reminders. So I would say that family members who are in doubt, you know, because some will be in doubt, I guess they should clarify this with their treating specialist.
When would you actually see the onset of the PTSD symptoms after the medical event?
You know, it can even happen quite delayed. It can go up to 6 months.
Right.
So it's not often having to happen right after the event. It can be delayed up to 6 months. But most often it tends to happen within the few weeks after discharge, because people have to resume their normal routines, right? But yet their life has changed because the medical event, let's say a heart attack, and you've recovered, but later on you start getting minor missed beats, your heartbeat starts racing. So those sort of things are reminders to the patient and can alarm a patient, you know, make them over alert. But yet, they also have to be alert. So finding the balance between not being hyper vigilant but being aware is important.
That's right.
So I would. So the period after discharge is potentially quite challenging for many individuals. Yes, and when they resume their normal routines.
Is there a way to prevent medical PTSD from occurring, or to at least recognize which situations would trigger it?
So definitely recognition goes a long way. Some of the things that could be done from us as clinicians would be, I guess, a more efficient and compassionate communication. Because the way that we take informed consent would be really important. And informed consent isn't just something where we just take a patient's permission to undergo surgery. That full explanation of what to expect, what are the possible side effects, and what is the possible outcome, and kind of giving the patient time to process that helps a lot. And also checking in with patients afterwards. You know, some of the interesting things that have been done overseas in especially in European countries, I think Britain, for example, ICU, okay, in the ICU critical care units there, they've actually started something called ICU diaries.
Right.
Which has been a fantastic way of helping patients not have PTSD after an ICU discharge.
Okay.
Because the family members, nurses, the staff would collectively write down what has happened to the patient for the day, so that when he leaves, he's given this diary, okay, where he's able to actually understand, oh, this happened to me, or they put a catheter in on that day, okay, so that was, I remember feeling quite scared, I felt like something was going into me, so he can make sense of what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
So the ICU diaries apparently have really assisted a lot in reducing the amount, reducing the occurrence of PTSD in these patients.
Okay, all right. Yeah. That's a very good point, because I wanted to sort of round up with some thoughts from you about how we can integrate caring for a patient's mental health into the treatment paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we see more and more people coming into contact with the healthcare system, and as people live longer with chronic conditions, we cannot deny the fact that there's a certain proportion who are going to experience some form of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So apart from clinicians being aware and perhaps making measures like keeping some sort of ICU care diary, what else can we do to integrate mental health care into the whole treatment paradigm?
Definitely education to family members, caregivers, and societies as a whole, okay, communities as a whole. And the idea that when people are unwell, I mean, you know, you really need to lean in to your tribe, isn't
yes.
it? It really makes a difference to have a sense of support. That itself is so protective, and support that is willing to actively listen. Because I would say that often there's too much advice.
Yes. Well-meaning
yes. advice.
But it can be misdirected, perhaps.
Correct. Yeah. So many people want to offer knowledge quickly to, let's say, their loved one who's been unwell. But actually, maybe their loved one just needs to be heard.
Right.
And when I mean active listening, truly, you know, asking some questions, relevant questions to help the person share what's going on with them, rather than straight away butting in with, okay, you should drink this, or you should have this, or this would make you feel better. You know, I think sometimes not enough space is given to people who've been unwell to actually say, state what's on their mind.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot of isolation.
Yes, and by coming in straight away with advice, we prevent a person from really sharing. So support, active listening, practical approaches to accompany individuals into their normative routines. You know, you need people who help you do things. You know, you need people to help you relax. You may not need anyone to actively solve everything for you, but to help you resume the structure of your life, you know, at your own pace.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Bharathi.
Yeah.
I've been speaking to consultant psychiatrist and geriatric psychiatrist, Dr. Bharathi Vengadesalam, about PTSD that occurs after a traumatic medical experience. If you are experiencing any of the symptoms that we've described, or you know of anyone going through the experience, please seek medical help as it can be treated. You can download our podcasts on mental health issues from our BFM app. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.